Next Chapter Podcasts. Next Chapter Podcasts.
Hi, and welcome back to How I Got Greenlit. I'm Alex Galegian.
I'm Ryan Gibson.
And we're here with noted producer Evan Ostrowski. Thanks for joining us, Evan.
Of course.
For first-time listeners, we are the Film Lovers podcast. We talk to leading filmmakers about how they got in the business, some significant moments in their career, and then they bring us a film to discuss that influenced them. Today, Evan brought us Manhunter, directed by Michael Mann, and our film choices are a little bit different. We like to do B-sides of famous directors. So he said Michael Mann, I said fine, just not Heat. And so he picked right. one of our favorites, which is called Manhunter. And we'll get into that later. Right now, thank you for joining us, Evan.
Of course.
Full disclosure, Evan and I went to NYU together and go way back. And I think moved out to LA around the same time, maybe within a year or two.
Yeah.
And have worked together on all kinds of fun stuff from feature films to stop motion animated digital episodes, pretty much anything and everything. Yeah, we're going to do a whole chapter on the rotten fruit. Don't worry. But anyway, welcome.
Welcome, Evan.
Thank you.
Ryan and I have worked together extensively as well. I forget how I introduced you guys. Was it on the feature or no?
Evan and I have known each other at this point, I think, for almost 20 years. I mean, no, wow. Probably 15 years.
No, but we worked together back in, '08, '09?
Yeah, we did commercial stuff together.
And onward.
Yes, Evan is what I would call, or what people call, a networker. He is a people person. He is got a lot of friends. He stays friends with a lot of people and constantly communicates. And that's his strength and weakness.
Although, people person, I'm sorry. I know you're not supposed to insult the guest right away, but
I'm a people person with everybody except Ryan, you know.
Right. Exactly. That might be true.
Ryan, you got to treat him more like a caged animal. And then you really get great results that way.
So. Yeah, he likes to poke the bear, so to speak.
Yeah,
so.
There you go. I got a good poker.
Yeah, Evan, so how did you find your love in the beginning when you were young? Can you take us back to the beginning and where you found your love for film or movies or cinema, whatever you want to call it, the magic of? Can you start back in, you know, when you were a kid, like your first inkling of?
Sure.
That would be great.
Yeah. I mean, like for me, it wasn't like, wasn't a big, when I was a kid, realization, like sitting in the movie theater, even though, you know, I did have, I think, my 7th or 8th birthday, which happens to be in May. We went to go see Star Wars, which was just going to be this, you know, fun, big, fun, cool movie that was going to come out. But mostly later on, when I got into my teenage years, my parents moved out to California. Our neighbor at the time had a nephew going to AFI for grad school, and they knocked on our door and said, hey, can we shoot this shot that involves like your front door or something? And my mom was like, what? I don't get it. And these young guys and gals. And my mom was like, yeah, sure. Anything you want to do, you just got to have my son be your PA. And, she wanted to get me out of the house, or I don't know what the hell was going on. And I hung out with these like 22, 25, 4-year-old guys and gals, like for 2 days. It was super fun. And that's when I kind of realized, hey, you know, like you can go to school for this. Like, this is cool. And at the time I was doing some high school theater stuff and I was thinking, well, maybe I should get serious about it. But, and then I looked in the mirror and I realized I was kind of goofy looking. So maybe I'm better behind the camera than in front of the camera.
Now, you did do acting didn't you go to a high school in Los Angeles?
Yeah, yeah. I went to LOXO, which is the kind of high school for the performing arts here in LA, you know, for my last 2 years of high school, and I graduated there. And it was an amazing experience. It's a wonderful school. I highly recommend it. My daughter goes there now. She's in the visual arts program. I really got a deep dive incredibly quickly into kind of the great masterworks of theater, Chekhov, Ibsen, Sam Shepard, on and on and on and on. And the arts professors there, the arts teachers were not like LAUSD certified, you know, like do your homework by 4 o'clock or you're going to get a C. These were like professional acting teachers, and that they came into the school and were part of the staff. And so, and the majority of them had gone to Juilliard or ACT and had acted professionally and were directing and doing whatnot. So, you know, they get handed these like 35 kids my junior year, and they kind of turn you into a theater troupe, and you do 5 or 6 shows, and you do scene study, you do audition techniques, you do Edith Skinner Standard American Speech, which is taught at Juilliard. You do the Suzuki method of movement, which is taught at Juilliard. It was amazing. It really taught me 2 really important things, that this is what I want to do with my life, and meaning I want to be in the arts. But it also taught me, being surrounded by such talented actors that were way beyond me, that, you know what, I'm going to film school. Like I was all in on film school, like as a sophomore or junior. Locks really helped me kind of get there. And that's where Alex and I went. We went to NYU, and the rest is the rest.
I just want to go back just for a second, because when you said these weren't your ordinary LAUSD teachers, they were professionals working in the field at the time, like they had
experience. Very much so. I mean, the day's structured still the exact same way, you know, because my daughter goes there. The morning is all academics taught by LAUSD teachers, and they're great. And then you have lunch, and then for 4 hours or 3.5 hours, you go to your conservatory classes, which are taught by industry professionals. And it's a really great immersive program for anybody, any young person that's very serious about the arts. They have acting, visual arts, music, dance, and filmmaking now. They didn't have film when I was there. They added that a few years after I left, but that's one of the majors now.
So you went through that program, you realized you wanted to be a part of it, but not necessarily the part that you kind of went there for, which was acting. So you went through that program, and then you said you ended up in NYU with Alex. How did that take place? Because you're in Southern California, you could have gone to USC, you could have gone to UCLA Film School, like Coppola. Like, how did you...
I went to USC for a year, and I hated it from the go. Like, I was just in the wrong place at the wrong, you know, it was just not a great fit. I thought it would be a great fit. I was interning at a company that barely exists, you know, it still exists, called TriStar, while I was at USC, but I didn't fit into the culture there. And the thing about Lox is that the high school I was at, the kids are heavily recruited there to go to all the major arts universities. So I remember when the NYU representative came out to our school, she handed out business cards to all of us and said, "Hey, my name is, I think her name is Rebecca. I can't remember her last name because it's been a minute." And I kept her card like in my whatever backpack. And I remember I called her like, I think right before Thanksgiving break.
You were already going to USC.
I was at USC. I met some really good people there, but I didn't feel right. And so I called her and she said, "Look, why don't you apply for sophomore year? Fax me your application before you snail mail it in," which is what you did back in the day, "and then I'll help kind of push it through." And I was like, "All right." And then I did that. I think I did it all over Christmas break. And then I got a letter in the mail like the day before classes started that I got into NYU Film School. And so I knew where I was going in sophomore year, and, you know, couldn't wait to get out back to New York. And I moved out there and went there from sophomore year on through my senior year and loved it.
Right. That's where you grew up. I don't think we covered
originally,
that.
Originally grew up in the New York area, New York City, Connecticut, Long Island, all that.
And wait, you got a letter the day before classes started?
Yeah. The recruiter was wonderful. I think she even called me after my fax arrived, because it was like a 47-page fax. I remember sending the fax from my mom's office to where she used to work for the Fidelity in Century City. Thanks, Fidelity, for letting me use your fax machine. Because they were like harder to find like in the early 90s, you know? And she called me and said, "You're in," and a letter should be there in a day or so. And it arrived like that day or something. So
wow. Yeah,
it was great.
So let me ask you this. So you have a kid in high school in the creative arts school that you went to. Is she going to go into the film business?
I hope not.
That was kind of my follow-up question. Like, because almost everyone I know in the business with kids are like, I'm just pray they don't follow me down this dark road.
I wish they had a performing arts school for dentistry.
Did you say when she wanted to go to that school, did you question?
Yeah. Were you like, really?
No, not at all. I mean, like, every kid is different, as you know.
Also, you had a great experience there.
I had a great experience there, and the ability for me to get into the university or universities of my choice was a lot easier because of that, because it has a marquee name in the high school world. And then, you know, the flip side of that is, you guys both know, my wife's an animator and a really talented artist and painter and drawer, is that a word?
Drawer.
Artist.
Drawer. Yeah, but my, you know, my wife's a, you know, been an
illustrator,
5 year plus, like 3D computer animators, you know, her IMDb credits are like longer than all of ours combined.
She's a CG seasoned veteran, like when CG, like from the dawn of, like, yeah, Pixar. Like
video toasters.
Yeah, video, yeah.
Dude, she used to do Dave Letterman's top 10 list on CG.
Oh, nice.
That was her first job right out of school. So she gets a lot of talent from my wife, particularly in the visual arts. And you know what? Like, if she goes into the arts, great. Like, you know, like, I'm all for it. You know, it's got to be right for the kid. You know, my oldest son's going to engineering school in the fall, and it's right for him. I had no reservations at all. In fact, we're going to she's going with me to the high school reunion next week, funny enough.
Wow.
Yeah. The thing I remember about NYU specifically, particularly as we became like juniors and seniors, is that the people that were like making films, you know, like that got into like the thesis classes and pitched their way, you know, Eli Roth, of course, you know, was in my class as well. The kids that made films and really put their nose to the grindstone as seniors, I tended to be the ones that kept doing it when they graduated, because you know, NYU, as you remember, was like, it was a little bit like a free for all. Like, you had to fight your way to get your film made. But if you put up a good fight, you're going to get your film made. But if you phoned it in, the professors were like, no, dude, like, nah, come back next week. And as long as you kept up the battle, then you win. And I always thought that was a great proving ground for filmmaking, but it's the same when you graduate. You graduate, you're like, okay, now what? Like, how the, you know, there is no class at NYU called, now what? How do I get my film made? I mean, by the way, there should be, but I'll be honest with you, like, what the fuck is it going to be in that class? You know, like, how do you teach that?
Yeah, but that opens up a whole host of stuff that I always complain about. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I'll probably do like one or two lectures at friends' film classes or writing classes or whatever a year. And I'm always like, well, what do you guys want to be when you grow up or whatever? And they were just like we were, which is, yeah, we listen. We went to our classes. We listened to the professor, blah, blah, blah. But I always leaned forward and was like, this is a working director, or this is an actor you've heard of. And like, those lecture halls would be crowded, and the Q&A after would go on for 2 more hours than the lecture, in terms of like, well, how did you get started? And how did you get an agent? And what is it really like? And they're still like that.
That's what was great about NYU. Because, I mean, we had the Coen brothers came by. Spike Lee was like teaching there. Like, I always used to bump into him in the damn elevator. Yeah, Lasse Hallström came. It went on and on. Were you at the screening when they showed Reservoir Dogs?
No.
Dude, they showed, so like the distributors on Friday afternoons would bring films to NYU, and it would just be like for free for students.
Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, sometimes the directors comes if they were namey, sometimes they wouldn't. And they'd show some goofball film like first, and I'd watch it. And then the distributor was like, hey, we have this new film coming out called Reservoir Dogs. You guys should check it out. It stars Harvey Keitel. And I remember like half of us stayed, and you know, it was like Friday afternoon, you know, like what else are we going to do except like go hit a bar or something. And then like, I was just riveted. Like, I mean, it was like somebody stapled me to my chair. And you know, that first shootout, you know, was like, I'm like, what is this movie? And I wish Tarantino had come, but like, we had never heard of the guy. And And I remember telling people, like, was that movie amazing, or was it just me? And we were like, holy, yeah, we were all blown away. So that was another great thing about NYU, was just the exposure to film, the filmmakers, and seeing a lot of those films early, you know? So anyways, that's what I remember.
So my NYU Harvey Keitel moment is the first week I got there. I'm in the dorms, and I have a couple of goofy roommates. And we walk outside Union Square on the curb, Harvey Keitel shooting Bad Lieutenant. And I'm kind of like, whoa. But this goofy roommate of mine.
Do you know at the time it was Bad Lieutenant or no?
I know. Yes, it was definitely Bad Lieutenant. So,
no, I mean, you didn't.
Oh, no. We just knew, like, that's fucking Harvey Keitel standing outside our dorm.
Right.
And I'm like, wow, I'm in the big city now, you know, like whatever, like skyscrapers and everything. And so I just was kind of staring at, like, ooh, cameras and lights and flags. And
yeah.
And my roommate walks up to him and he goes, hey, you're Harvey Keitel. He's like, yeah. And he goes, why'd you get fired off of Apocalypse Now?
Oh my God. Are you... Did he get punched, as he probably should have?
Well, he definitely did the classic Harvey Keitel take, where his face started to pinch into, like, a single point. Like,
that's all bad.
Who the fuck are you to talk to me like that? I mean, he didn't scream, but he was like, get the fuck out of here. You know, like,
good for Harvey. Good for Harvey. You know what? Hey, that's New York City rules, man.
I couldn't believe it. I was just like, wow.
That's a true story. That's a
honest
true story.
To God.
Yeah.
It's honest to God.
I don't doubt it. I mean, finally, that's how I got my first job in New York. I was walking up by I was in downtown, actually. I take it back. I was in downtown and I walked by a movie set and I saw them filming and I asked the PA what it was. And they told me it was called Tribeca. And it was a pilot starring Lawrence Fishburne. And I was like,
I vaguely remember this. Yeah.
So I was, can I get a job in this? And the guy's like, I don't know. And he slipped me the call sheet, which had the production company address. So I went home and I had a little small stack of resumes ready to go. I wrote a handwritten letter to the ADs. Matt Wiener, and I can't remember the first AD, but Matt Wiener.
Oh, come on. Not the same.
I mean, Matt Wiener was second. He was second AD. And I mailed it like that day. And he calls me like 3 days later and says, hey, I heard you came by because I wrote in my letter and I hate NYU students. I was like, okay.
I would hire you, but fuck you.
Mouth. Second thing out of his mouth.
He said, I hate NYU students.
I hate NYU students. I never hire them, but I liked your letter. I liked your gumption. What are you doing tomorrow? Could you be here at 9 or whatever it was? I was like, yes, 100%. He goes, if you're 1 minute late, don't even try to find me. I was like, so I showed up like 30 minutes early, which he liked. And then they just put me to work. And I remember I was so nervous and the AD crew was like working for a bunch of like steelhead and Marines. I would like run. They'd give me and say, hey, Evan, I want you to go here and do this. And that. And I'd run. And they all start laughing, you know, like, look at NYU kid running. But that's how I kind of earned my stripes with that crew of guys and gals. And I worked with them for like 2+ maybe 3 years. And then I did Tribeca with them. I did Home Alone with them. And I did a Wolf with them and a bunch of other things.
With that production crew, you did Tribeca and Home Alone and Wolf?
We did Tribeca, the TV show. Then we did Home Alone 2. I might be getting in reverse order because I'm so old.
Are you talking about Wolf with Jack Nicholson?
Then we did the Jack Nicholson Wolf film.
Wait a minute. You're burying the lead. So did you meet Donald Trump on the set of Home Alone 2?
I did not. On the set of Home Alone 2, my job was to go into the floor above where they were filming and to have a walkie-talkie. And for 12 hours a day, I was to ask the cleaning women very nicely to not vacuum during the rolls. And there were all these lovely Jamaican gals And there was like four or five of them. This was like the middle of the day. It's like nobody's in the plaza. They're all out in the city. And then I'd like sprint up and down the hallways and I would say to them, and hey, ladies, please, 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 we're about to, oh, and they were so nice. And they were like, you know, we'd stand there like, you know, while they'd roll and cut. And that's I did that. And
that's always what's happening off screen. People don't realize that everyone's frozen in time.
Frozen, standing there. Hey, don't vacuum, you know, anyways. But yes, that was my first job and how I got into PAing. You know, I was in New York, PA.
Was Home Alone 2 fully filmed in Trump Plaza?
We did a ton of stuff in the plaza. And then one of the big sequences I'll remember the most is when Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern are chasing Macaulay Culkin kind of across whatever it is, 59th Street into the Intercentral Park with like, you know, 1,000 extras at Christmas time.
How do you like the ice, kid? Let's go for a little stroll in the park.
I was standing on one of the corners trying to hold back the regular folk from like, and it's like, you know, like Tuesday at like 6:00. So there's like a 500 people.
And look, hold on, because there has to be some explanation here. You can only ask them nicely to not enter the shot.
Agreed. It's very true.
And this is New York, by the way.
This is probably one of the busiest corners in Manhattan, except for Times Square. But they'd sent me to this corner thinking, oh, Evan will handle it. It's not that crazy. But they'd sent one of New York Finest with me, thank God. And I said, hey, everybody, wait, everybody, just wait. And the light turned green. And I was like, everybody, wait. And then everybody was, all the New Yorkers were super nice. They waited. And then some guy, some New Yorker, I didn't see him. He grabs me by my lapels and, you know, it's the middle of winter, starts to pull me like he's going to knock me out. And then over my right hand shoulder, I see a policeman's baton, like, poke this guy, I'm saying like whack him. They didn't strike him down like a baseball bat, but they batoned him once in the center of his chest, right where just below his necktie. And the guy let me go. The policeman grabbed him and took him aside and like reamed him one and said, don't you ever touch anybody in this city ever again like that. That is not cool. And, you know, and he's like, this is just some kid doing his job. I mean, and I was like, you know, he didn't hurt the guy, but he scared the shit out of me. and he stunned this dude. It was a big guy, you know, it was like a big Wall Street.
Wait, he was going to take a chunk out of you. Is that what was going to happen?
This guy pulled me off my feet and like was dragging me towards like in one motion. And this policeman essentially like saved me and like, you know, like,
wow,
popped this guy back. And did it in a really, you know, in the right way. And, you know, that's life in the big city, man.
Let him go after that.
Oh, yeah, right? Yeah. It was like, wow. Just like, keep on walking, asshole. Keep on walking. It was a lot of that.
A firm talking to. Yeah, I mean, that's what's hilarious is that for us, like I said, even just like seeing the Harvey Keitel thing, like at that time, there was a ton of production in New York. So you could have that treat of like turning a corner. And you didn't care what it was, TV, movie, whatever. You're just like, wow, there's trucks and people and movement. And it's like the circus is in town.
And New York had not been fully cleaned up at that point yet.
That was the production value was urban squalor.
tagging.
Yeah, no, I remember shooting in Soho. It was dangerous, you know, and now it's like you could eat off the floor. But further to Evan's point, I just remember it got to the point where some New Yorkers would be like, would purposely make noise and then you'd pay them off. Like they understood how production worked and what, you know, silence or whatever was needed. And so like certain, you know, kind of scammy guys would be there purposely making noise until, you know, some production manager kind of took them aside and slipped them a few bucks and then they walked away and it became like a hustle.
Or you told your police escort to go shut those guys up.
Exactly. Yes. They were only too happy to have a reason to handle someone. Yes.
You, get over here. You, shut the fuck up. You know, it was a lot. I loved it. It was great.
Thank you again for joining us on How I Got Greenlit. We really appreciate you coming along for the ride. But before we go any further, I'd like to get a little serious with you all for a second. I know you've got plenty on your plate to think about these days, but something that affects all of us is the fact that Mother Nature is taking a beating these days. Wildfires, water shortages, and just plain weird weather are an unfortunate fact of life these days. The truth is, it's only going to get worse over the next few decades. So, you might ask yourself, what can we do? One thing we do is get educated. Next Chapter Podcast and the Clio Institute have teamed up on a podcast called House on Fire, co-hosted by Katrina Irwin, a 24-year-old climate activist, and Caroline Lewis, the founder of the Clio Institute. House on Fire is a youth-centered podcast that takes its name from Greta Thunberg's famous speech. It's youth-focused because, let's face it, us adults are leaving a pretty huge mess to clean up for the next generation. Each episode invites scientists, activists, artists, and more to have important conversations about this complex crisis. And the topics they cover could help you make decisions about how you might want to vote or spend your hard-earned money in the ways that leave behind a better world for those to come. So listen to House on Fire wherever you get your pods to stay informed and involved, or go to thecleoinstitute.org to learn more. Now, let's get back to how I got greenlit.
Here's always the eternal question about film school. Was it worth it, Evan?
Yes.
Okay. And when we were there, I remember there was a universal attitude, at least for the hungry ones, where after a year and we got the basics of like how a camera worked, how a light worked, how to record sound, we were all like, fuck this place, man. Let's go make a feature. You know, like I remember a lot of us were like, for the amount of tuition we're paying, we should just take our senior year tuition, pool it together and make a feature, you know, which we tried to do and failed. But the real value is, I think, what we're talking about now, the network, the friendships, the relationships, the bonds that you make, then what, you know, lasts to this day.
I agree. I mean, you know, you end up, a lot of us ended up out here in LA and, you know, you're on the lot or you're at El Pollo Loco. And I mean, that was the last time I saw Todd Phillips. He like came up behind me in El Pollo Loco in Burbank before the pandemic. And no joke, he said to me in his classic, like creepy low voice, just to mess with me, he goes, "You got any naked pictures of your mom?" And I turn around and I'm like, Todd. He's like, "Evan, what are you doing, buddy?" I'm like, "Holy crap." You know, like, yeah.
So he really is the guy that opens the door and says, "I'm here for the gangbang."
That's his sense of humor, man. I mean, he did. That was the funniest thing I'd heard in like a
that's
year,
great.
You know, but
yeah, that's great.
That's also how we got movies made. I mean, the first two films I made were with directors I went to school with, you know, Gustavo and with Eli, you know, so yeah.
And now you've brought us to the threshold of Eli Roth.
Okay.
So my way in before we get into the saga that is Cabin Fever was I vaguely knew Eli as the guy that made the crazy short film at NYU about like, what if Ronald McDonald was like a serial killer or something? Do you remember that movie that he did?
Oh yeah, no, he made it. We were in senior thesis class together. It was actually the Burger King.
The Burger King King? He actually is more of a psychopath than Ronald.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not going to picture the movie because I think it's unpitchable, but essentially it was like the first 2 minutes of Eli's NYU thesis film are the funniest thing I still might have ever seen. The rest of it I can't comment on.
And yeah, what is it called? Can we Google it?
I think
it
was called Restaurant Dogs. And
yes, that's right. It was so there you go. He must have been there at that screening and was inspired, right? Reservoir Dogs with the mascots of fast food restaurants.
Yeah,
right?
Jack in the Box. It was a Reservoir Dogs takeoff, and the big dumb idea, which was really well done, was that this guy, Randy Perlstein, goes into a Burger King and he wants a milkshake at like midnight and they don't have one. And the milkshake machine's not working, and he complains. And the manager comes out and the manager's like, "Look, there's nothing I can do." And Randy's funny. The script was funny. I was like, "Oh, this is fun." And then Randy goes, "Okay, I want to see the king." And he's like, "Oh yeah, you want to see the king?" He goes, "I want to see the Burger King." And he goes, and so like, and then wackiness ensues. So like, and I was like, "Oh, that's really funny. Like, that's a great." And Eli I remember him pitching this film. You know, we had Boris Fruman as our professor, who was a Iron Curtain raised, you know, imagine if Clint Eastwood was Russian. I mean, this is who our professor was. And he had this guy in stitches. Anyways, he made the film and it was, you know, it was a student film. I think he got like a Student Academy Award nod or something for it.
Wow.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, it definitely put him on the map. And then years later, you brought me in. This was like late 90s when the first digital revolution had happened. And people were like, this internet thing's going to be TV. And there was all these popped up like companies that came out of nowhere and had a bunch of money and wanted to make shows, right? So he had created a show called The Rotten Fruit, which was like, what if the Sex Pistols were a bunch of fruit? And like mayhem ensued, and it was a stop motion thing.
Yep.
And you were producing it, and Roy Wood was involved. He had another show, and we actually set up in a Burbank, an abandoned firehouse.
You have to talk about who Roy Wood is, though. Also,
so Roy Wood is actually a legendary stop motion director, which I don't even know. How did you meet Roy?
One of my first jobs when I moved to LA was I produced the last season of the stop motion shorts for the Fox show In Living Color. I mean, they were all these stop motion shorts, and Roy was like the lead art director animator under this guy, this other animator, this more senior animator, Corky Quakenbush. So we did them all together, and Roy and I became fast friends, and that's how I kind of got my interest in my first kind of exposure to stop motion. Roy and I did make a stop motion animated feature, which when we first ran it by the MPAA for ratings, they gave it an X. So we had to recut it. And I remember thinking to myself, guys, it's clay. Like, yeah, why are you? And they're like, it's still a dick. That's a clay dick. You have to cut out the clay dick. Like, because you get this report and you're like, no penises, like a lot.
No simulated like, cock.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't. Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, we're.
Yeah, no, we're way off the path.
We digress.
Takes us into, you know, what I would call like your greenlit moment, which is Cabin Fever, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that we were, it was that sort of liminal period between graduating NYU, maybe coming out here, PAing, like kind of entry level stuff, bumbling around, big dreams, bad scripts that you write at night and cha-cha-cha. You know, take us through it. Like you're friends with Eli after school and he says, hey, I got a thing, or did you know, how did this all come
about? It actually kind of ties back to The Rotten Fruit, because what I had made a film before then in Brazil with our friend Gustavo Lipstein called Dead in the Water. And we'd gotten Henry Thomas and Dominique Swain to star in it, and which was like a coup. And then, you know, five companies wanted to finance it. And so we went down to Brazil and we made the film. And I don't know if you remember, but I had started The Rotten Fruit as the producer, and then I had to leave because Dead in the Water got greenlit. And I was like, dude, I'm going to Brazil. And I remember telling Eli, and he's like, well, what do you mean you're leaving? I'm like, look, my buddy Alex is going to step in. You're going to love him. It's going to be great. And then I'm like, I got to go to Brazil. And then as I left, like the day before I left, Eli said to me, he's like, dude, did I tell you about this script I wrote called Cabin Fever? And I'm like, no. And he said, well, it was under option by some other group for like a year, and the option was coming up in like a week. And he was like, read it on the plane, or just when you get back, we got to make this film. So I read it, and it was perfect in a lot of ways. It really was. I mean, I got to give Eli the credit, man. I was laughing out loud. I was never a huge horror fan, but it was so Eli. You know, when you know the filmmaker as well as I knew Eli, like when Eli moved to LA, he like lived on my couch for a month, you know, and I was like a newlywed. I just got married, you know, so my wife was like, really, Evan? And then, but when you can hear the voice of the filmmaker in your head as you read it, it just brought it so much to life. And Eli, like our plan, he was like, dude, okay, let's get Henry Thomas to play the lead and we'll get Dominique Swain to play one of the gals. And I was like, yeah, dude, like that's what I'm going to do. And none of that happened. So then I came back from filming in Brazil and Eli and I just started working together. And we were like, we got to cast the film. And I was like, all right. And I'd worked with this really awesome casting director named Io Davis, who is now, I think, the president of film entertainment at Disney. She reports directly to the head of Disney. She's like been killing it in a great way for the past like 15 years at Disney. She became the head of casting at ABC, then the head of casting at Disney, and now she's the president of film entertainment. And her casting partner, Joe, brought in all these wonderful actors, and we just started to kind of put it together. We felt like if we got a cool cast, the money would come, which was completely, you know, ignorant of us. What had really happened was that while I was making Den the Water, another film had Henry Thomas and Dominique Swain. We were getting them from their set to our set. They had the same agent, Tracy Brennan at ICM, who's now at CAA. And she would package them a lot in these small indies. So they were going from my friend Lauren's film to my film in Brazil. And Lauren and I struck up a friendship on the phone because I needed them to go to like the embassy and get their visa and they'll do, you know, do some stuff while they were filming her movie in North Carolina. And I remember saying to Lauren, you know, on the phone, I was like, oh, you have been so helpful. Like when we get back to LA, like, let me buy you lunch. Like, you know, like I really owe you a solid. And we did that. And so, and you know, like producers do, we exchange scripts. Like she gave me one of something she was developing. And I was like, I remember she's like, so like, what are you working on? I'm like, I only got this one thing, Cabin Fever. And she read it and she loved it. And then she called me and said, I'd love to meet Eli. I've got an investor in North Carolina. The guy, I think, will do it. He owns a Holiday Inn that he built a small soundstage in the parking lot. He owns a prop shop, a costume shop, and about 19 vehicles in just outside of Greensboro, North Carolina. What do you guys say? And we were both like, hell yeah. You know, like, let's go. So we go to North Carolina with one quarter of the budget committed from our producing partner, Sam Frelick. And we were in talks with multiple parties to close the rest of it. And none of it closed. And we started shooting with no money because we had blown through the 250 grand that Sam had committed. And then it got hairy. You know, to Eli's credit, Eli had been working as David Lynch's assistant. We had attached David as an executive producer to the film, which most people don't know, but he's not in the credits anywhere. David had said to Eli before we had all left, he had said, listen, you know, I can't do a David imitation. I'm sure everybody else can, but he had said, whatever happens,
remember, whatever happens,
whatever happens, man, just remember, it's your job to only think about what's going on in those 35 millimeter frames. Like, ignore the noise and just make that the best you can. And it was great advice because there was a lot of noise. I mean, we didn't have money for payroll. We were shooting on short ends. It was a lot.
Let's define that. So short, and back in the actual chemical emulsion film days, short ends were when it was the leftovers of a 400 foot roll from a film processing, like when you bought the film.
Yep.
Students and very low budget films could buy kind of the leftovers. It's sort of like it's a difference between a steak and hamburger. You're getting like
each load, you know, which would take 2 to 5 minutes to load onto the Panavision camera we had. We weren't exactly sure how long it would last. You know, the second assistant camera would say, I think it's 89 feet. And then the DP would do the math and he'd be like, 36 seconds. Okay, get ready to roll. And we'd be like, we got a 36. That's all we got in the camera. Yeah. All right. Make it work. You know, and that's where Eli was really great at just what I would call transcending the script, making it his own, throwing lines at the actors, doing improvisational things with them to get the best out of them, and you know, making it a fun set. Because the truth of it is, it was, you know, we were on the Titanic trying to plug the hole as it was going down, on the phone trying to raise money, trying to keep the unions at bay. It was the best, worst film I'd ever been a part of.
How did you survive? Where did the money end up coming from? By the way, this happens more often than people would think, by the way.
It does. I mean, I had been spoiled a little bit on my first film because we'd gotten these, you know, somewhat namey actors, and we had a good budget. We made Dead in the Water for almost $2 million. in the case of Cabin Fever, you know, I think we'd bitten off more than we can chew. And Sam Frelick and his group was able to put up another, I think, $250,000 to kind of cut the first week payroll to the crew. And then we were sprinting because I think we all knew that the next payroll was we weren't going to make it. And then everybody called their parents and their friends and their blah, blah, blah. And I think we cobbled together, you know, another $100,000, paid some people, didn't pay some people. We were supposed to shoot for 25 days. We shot for like 19. We left town with like $300,000 in local debt from all the rental companies and all this other stuff. And I'm
being very truthful. I think you meant you skipped town.
Dude, we skipped town like, and we didn't pay the crew the last week's salary, which is one of the, it's a horrible thing to say. And to this day, it still makes my stomach churn.
You never paid the crew for that?
That's not, no, we did pay them.
Oh, okay.
We had also been flipped, but we didn't have the money at the time. So the union showed up.
This was a non-union project
in North Carolina. One day, four guys that were extras from The Sopranos or looked like they were before The Sopranos existed showed up on our set and said, with heavy New Jersey accents, I'm a proud former Livingston guy, you are now a union shoot, and that's it. And in our union deal, if the film came out and hit a certain threshold, we would give the crew a bump, which we did. If we missed a payment, it would accrue interest or something like that, some sort of interest accruing. And so when we got back to LA, you know, we with our tails between our legs and a lot of short ends, Eli and our editor, Ryan Folzi, whose dad was a legendary editor, George Folzi, George kind of oversaw the edit as well. They put together a cut real quick. Our executive producer, Susan Jackson, who's no longer with us, within about a month of editing, she said, get me like a VHS with 5 minutes of footage, like some sort of scenes. And don't make a trailer. Just get me something I can show investors that the movie's done, kind of. And she put together, she brought in a group called Deer Path out of the East Coast. They loved it. And they said, okay, how much you need? And we're like, I don't know, $1 million or whatever it was, 900,000. That money went to A, paying the crew the last kind of week and a half's wages we owed. It included paying off all the money we owed back in North Carolina. It paid to finish the film. And then it paid for the 3 or 4 days of additional shooting we needed because we didn't finish the script. You know, we shot in Griffith Park at night for 3 or 4 days
to double for the woods.
Yeah. We shot.
Oh, well, explain that. So you cut it all together and you're like, wait, we have huge gaps in like sort of narrative.
I mean, we knew what we didn't shoot. You know, it wasn't a mystery. We thought, well, we could live without this gag, with the deer going through the car with Ryder Strong. We couldn't afford to do it. Then we got the money investment. We could do it. The at night kind of like harmonica gag, you know, party. You know, a bunch of stuff that Eli really felt passionate about, that was important to the film, that gave it that kind of, you know, goofiness, that goofy fun. You know, mm-hmm. we had to kind of leave it by the wayside in North Carolina, but we picked it up in LA. And then we finished the film and got it into the Toronto Film Festival. And one of the first, or I think it might have been the second or third year, they had started the Midnight Madness section. And then it went to Midnight Madness, and then it sold for $15 million.
Wow.
So, and then it sold for $15 million.
I mean, I don't know how else to say it. I mean,
yeah,
it's a great punchline, but let's chop it up a little bit. So you shoot it for under $1 million, and with all the
all in true costs were $1.5 million.
Okay, so $1.5 million with all this like stop start, and we're out of money, and we find a new angel arrives at just the right moment, and like most stories of most indie films, and you get it done. And did you have friends that had friends at Toronto? Like, tell us about...
What? No, friends.
You just literally came off the fucking turnip truck and just...
Susan Jackson, again, our EP was also our sales agent. And okay. She decided that she was very close with Cassian Elways, who was the biggest agent at William Morris that sold finished films, and they had partnered. So we had submitted the film to the film festival, And when William Morris submits a film to the film festival, it maybe goes to the front of the line, but there's
that's what I was trying to
no
say.
Guarantee.
Make fun of
there's
me.
No guarantees. Yeah, but, there's no guarantees.
But well, there's equal and there's
no
there's
no no equal, no. I know. Right? I mean, I've been doing this a lot of years, and I'll tell you this. And if you know, Cassian will tell you the same thing. You know what? He can make the call. They'll take his call. They're like, right. "Hey, thank you. This is great. We can't wait to see it." And then you sit and you wait.
We'll get back to you.
Then they called and said, "We love it." But here's the funny thing. They said, "Look, we love it. We're going to put it in the second week of the festival. There's a couple other like horror films that we're going to do premieres and we're going to do that kind of thing with. But yours is going to come in the second week." And we're like, "What, really?" Like, okay, well, we're just happy to be here. So that's important because nothing sold in at Toronto in the first week of the festival. There was no, you know, the King's Speech. There was no The Cave or anything. There was nothing. Nothing had sold. So all the buyers were like dying to buy something. And so at our like Wednesday afternoon preview screening, all the film acquisition executives like jammed in there. I had to give up my seat. I'm standing in the back with like Lauren and Cassian and Susan, and 10-12 minutes in or one of the executives, one of these acquisition people like runs out, and we're like, oh my God. It was like one of the first murder scenes or something. And when we light the guy on fire, and we're like, oh God, oh, they're barfing. And then no, they were on their BlackBerry calling their bosses saying, because I was like, I walked out and they were like, listen, there's this film. We got to buy it. It's called Cabin Fever, you know? And we're like, okay, Alex, you know who was in that audience?
Uh-uh.
Was Gary Wax.
Nice.
Gary, our
fellow, fellow NYU guy who was a Miramax acquisitions guy.
He was working for Miramax and I saw him going. Yeah. He was like, oh, look at you, Evan. Hey, you got a film here. Hey, buddy, that's great, man. I can't wait to see it. And then like an hour and a half later, he was like, What do I got to do to buy this film? And I was like, talk to Cassian. Like, sorry, bro. Like, our relationship doesn't exist during the festival. I love you. I mean it. Like, to this day, Gary, salt of the earth, awesome guy. But, like, you know, we both know the rules. And I remember the lights come up. Nobody claps. This is a bunch of industry assholes. And everybody storms Cassian and Susan. And Cassian, as he sees the hordes coming, he kind of like shoves me, Lauren, and Eli outside. And he's like, go back to your hotel rooms. Don't answer your phones. Don't talk to anybody. And then we're like, okay, what just happened? And then he was setting the tone for the negotiation. And then he said, I'm not talking to any of you. I will see you at the after party tonight. And we were like, what?
But Cassian, they have checks in hand.
Like, no. Dude, this is why Cassian is a legend, because he knows what he's doing. He was like, make him wait. Right. And then that night, we showed it to 1,500 people in Toronto, real people, not industry schmucks. The house, everybody went bonkers.
Burned it down,
you know? And then we had this big ass after party, and that's when Cassian... Like all the film executives were outside trying to get in. And he was like, no, none of them are on the list. Don't let them in.
Oh my God.
We're all having drinks, like waving at these guys. And then finally Cassian and Susan go outside and started negotiating.
They're literally negotiating in the street.
Well, they're like, you know, I wasn't at present for this part of it, but basically
it was happening though.
It was on. Cassian was about to earn, you know, his percentage, which he did very, very well. Him and Susan just said, okay, what do you got? Give me a number. And it was like the fucking Price is Right. I mean, it was nuts. And then
it feels like that scene in Trading Places when it's like they come out to the floor and they're like, okay, 10 shares for you, 100.
Yes.
Okay. But
Cassian has ice water in his veins in the best way. And it continued to the next day. We all went to bed late. You know, it was like 3 a.m. And then, you know, I think we all get together for lunch. And then something had happened. Gary Wax called Harvey Weinstein and said, you got to come see this film. And Harvey didn't want to come. And then Gary's bosses said, no, get up here. So we got a call that Harvey was flying up. Can we get the print over to him? Because we didn't have a screening until like the next day or something. So the answer was, of course, yes. So Cassian and Susan got us all together and said, okay, we're going to let Harvey watch it. Lionsgate and a few of the other buyers had caught wind of this. And Lionsgate said, we want to start negotiating. Come to our suite in an hour, which is the same time that the film was supposed to start for Harvey. And the deal was, once you walk in, if you walk out, there's no deal. If we don't sign a piece of paper in that room, there's no deal. So we had arranged a slightly complicated signal amongst the parties to how to communicate, like if Harvey wanted it or not. And Harvey walked out of the film 20 minutes in and said, I don't like this movie. And the signal got to to our negotiators up in the Lionsgate suite, and we closed the deal with Lionsgate, and that was that.
You're going to love it. It's just peace and relaxation and relentless pounding for 6 days.
Don't forget about the beer.
Wow, place is amazing.
Sometimes you've known someone a really long time. And you just want to kiss them just to see if they're a good kisser. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Whoa, whoa.
Boy, that's how people get themselves shot.
It looks like you guys were having some kind of party last night.
She's sick. I'm not dying like that.
What are we dying?
I don't want to infect everyone.
That's how it goes down, folks. That's how it happens sometimes.
It's life in the NFL.
And so this is, we're some years down the line. Do you see that is this how a young filmmaker would experience a successful film festival to this day? Or has things changed? Or you talk to some people now and Netflix and the streamers with their sort of unlimited bank accounts kind of threw the whole foreign or film festival acquisition market out of whack, right?
I mean, they have to an extent, the amount of money that Cabin Fever made at Toronto, that number held as the record.
The record, yeah.
Up until relatively recently, and it was only beaten by Cassian Elwes again at Sundance.
with Mudbound
for 15 and change. But I mean, I would say this, it's like the film festival launching pad is still very real. Filmmakers can choose to hold on to their rights until then. Or, if they pre-shop the film and try to get it financed through Netflix or Hulu or Amazon, a lot of the deals I'm hearing are, we're going to do a negative pickup for what's called actual costs plus 20 or 25%. So you get a certified public accountant to send us the receipts, and whatever it costs you to make the film, we'll buy it plus 25%, and that's it.
And that's it.
It's actually not a bad deal for young filmmakers, but it puts a lot of onus on them to get investors to pay for it. That's kind of one version I've heard. Of course, all of the streamers and even the studios still finance films fully, mostly to more established directors.
With talent attached.
And then the majority, the festivals have still got the true indies. That's the discovery zone for new talent.
But it has changed quite a bit because the studios and the streamers have taken over a lot of, do you think Cabin Fever gets into Toronto if it comes out today?
Right.
I mean, I think it would,
You have to admit it is harder though for independent films to get into
without any real names. I mean, you had decent actors, but you didn't have.
Nobody was a name. I mean, it's very true. Oh, and I should tell you the Coda story for David Lynch.
Oh yeah. What happened with David Lynch?
David's still the smartest guy in the room. Wherever you go, having only met him in person once, with Eli. David said that when he saw the film, we screened it for him at his house before Toronto, and he loved it. he was laughing in like all the right places. And he was like, he was so proud of Eli. And it was a great moment for Eli. And he said, listen, I want to take my name off the film, which was in his contract to do. And Eli was like, what do you mean? And he said, if my name's on this film and you go to Toronto in 2 weeks or whatever it was, everyone's going to think I had something to do with how good this film is. And Eli, I didn't. I didn't give you notes. I wasn't on set. This is you. Like, this is your film. This is your, you know, your persona on screen. I don't want to distract from that. I'm doing you a favor. Take my name off it. You deserve whatever comes out of this because it's going to be great. And I remember Eli was at first deflated, but we all were, because I was like, what? What? David's taking his name? Angelo Badalamenti had done the score as a favor to Eli, you know, David Lynch's longtime composer. Mm-hmm. And we were like, fuck. And then we go to Toronto and we were all like, shit, David was right. You know, David was right. You know, the film like sold, and David Lynch, it wasn't a David Lynch thing. You know, it was an Eli, Evan and Lauren thing. Right. And that's how it should have been. And David knew that, you know, and he was at that place in his career. He didn't need to prove himself. He's fucking David Lynch.
Thank you for joining us for part one of our interview with producer Evan Ostrowski. Join us next week when we continue the conversation about his career and the influence of the film Manhunter, directed by Michael Mann. Join us on Twitter and Instagram at How I Got Greenlit. If you have any questions, comments, email us at howigotgreenlit@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Next Chapter Podcasts.